Indeed, what was he thinking? What was he feeling? Nicholas Meyer talks about that in the book, The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood. My wife remembers that when we first started dating, there were two people whose work I was very interested in, even though one had, you know, a lot of examples of what they were thinking and what they were feeling, Randy Newman, which I couldn't stop talking about, and the other was Nicholas Meyer. I didn't have much to go on, but I was interested in the movie time after time. And by the time I met my wife, Wrath of Khan had come out. But there was such a gap in between. So we'll talk about the gap in between those two movies and about how it was that Nicholas Meyer, not a Star Trek guy, ends up saving the Star Trek franchise. And in doing so, giving, you know, decades worth of pleasure for Trekkies like me. It's a very interesting story, and we'll get to the key element, which until reading this book, I would have suspected but didn't know was there, with Nicholas Meyer as he continues his story next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So contemplating the disappearance of Nicholas Meyer in between Time After Time and then Wrath of Khan, I remember thinking to myself, well, he's either really selective of a kind of the movies he gets involved with. He's some sort of film executive who occasionally dabbles in the actual product, or he's a head case. I remember thinking that at the time, going, I wonder why this guy so rarely, I'm not seeing him. And I thought, wow, what a cool movie. I would have thought after that, I would have been seeing a movie from you every year. And it was interesting to hear you talk about life after Time After Time and before the Wrath of Khan.
Well, as I recount in the book, I am, I suppose, picky about what I get involved with. And I had given my heart to making a movie out of the Robertson Davies Canadian novel, Fifth Business, and I had written the script and couldn't for the life of me understand, and in a way still can't, why that movie couldn't have found financing. But you know, I was sort of holding my breath, or I was sitting in my house and waiting for the phone to ring with somebody to write me a check. And then a friend of mine said, listen, Nicky, if you want to learn how to, you want to be a director, you ought to direct and not just sort of sitting here, being utterly passive, which isn't very like you. And this friend of mine, with whom I was flipping burgers over a barbecue one Sunday night, said, you ought to go down to Paramount and sit down with Harve Bennett, who is going to produce the second Star Trek movie. And I said, Star Trek, is that the one with the guy with the pointy ears? And she said, don't be a snob. I think you will like Harve Bennett. So I went down to Paramount. You know, some suggestions, if my parents had said this, I think I would have told them to take a hike. But it was not my parents, and so I went down to Paramount, and I did sit down with Harve Bennett, and I liked him very, very much. And he started, first he showed me the original Star Trek movie, and then he showed me episodes from Star Trek. And for a long time, I didn't quite understand what I was looking at. And then I thought, this does remind me of something that I really like a lot. And what was it? And what is it is, it was The Adventures of Captain Horatio Hornblower, this series of novels by C.S. Forrester that I read when I was a kid, and all about the adventures of a Napoleonic sea captain in the British Navy who has many adventures and a girl in every port. And I said, well, this Star Trek thing would seem to be essentially Hornblower in outer space. And so I kind of went with that idea, and I thought, well, this would be fun to make a Captain Hornblower movie in outer space, and that was sort of the beginning of my involvement.
Yeah, I think all of us Star Trek fans, I think the overwhelming majority of Star Trek fans love Wrath of Khan for many reasons. And as much as I, as a Star Trek fan, had been very excited about the first movie, it was really boring. And it took the fun out of Star Trek. Not, I mean, it made it, it felt like it was just really attempting to be really instructive. And I just, I didn't get it. And it's not that I didn't understand what Roddenberry was going for or what the director Robert Wise was going for. It just, it didn't get there to me in terms of a movie and a story arc. It just, it didn't hold. And that's what just, that was the difference of just Wrath of Khan was just, it was, well, it was something which, as I was watching it, I was relating to it, and I was interested to see that it pops up in your book, too. It's about this time, for me, I right about the time I was watching Time After Time, I started getting into opera. Uh-huh. And I had bought a book of libretti from a rummage sale. It was actually in, like a companion book to an RCA album series, and the albums were gone, but the book was left, and I was reading all of the various libretto from, right, from different operas, and I was so into opera, and I thought, oh, this is so interesting. And when I saw, this is how I got it, and again, not what you intended perhaps, but when I was watching Wrath of Khan, I was seeing space opera, and I was seeing Flying Dutchman. I thought there was an element of the Flying Dutchman, of Wagner's Flying Dutchman in it, and I was really digging it on that basis.
I think that I can't say that I was thinking of the Flying Dutchman, but there was no question that my own love of opera was certainly manifested in the Star Trek movies with which I was involved. I think generally opera, which is sort of life only stoned or something, it's like like life on LSD or something,
yeah,
where everything is just pure distilled emotion.
Right.
A sort of a heightened version of reality. That's my notion of what sort of movies and art generally ought to be. Leo Tolstoy said that the purpose of art is to teach you to love life, and to love life is to love God. And I never was quite sure about the last part of it, what it actually meant, but the first part of it I totally got. And I think that my take as a director, as a writer, as a dramatist is to, yeah, find the drama, find that heightened reality. And certainly that's what I went for, not only, as I say, in the Star Trek movies, but I think, you know, in general. I would also point out, by the way, that I am not the one to knock the first Star Trek movie, because I don't think I would have made a lot of the choices that I did make if Robert Wise and company hadn't boldly gone where no man had gone before when they tried to make a feature film of this. And so that whatever they, you know, did wrong, and I put wrong in quotation marks, it was somebody who went out there and was willing to make a fool of themselves first. And we've discussed the importance of that willingness.
Right.
And certainly I, you know, yield to no man where my respect or affection for Robert Wise is concerned.
Well, your name came up last night. I did a quick little open line segment last night before we had our main guest on, and somebody called in regard to, I think, what's a canard about you and Gene Roddenberry and about the first movie, and that somehow, you know, Gene Roddenberry was... how he was fired and the direction that the second movie went in. And I think some people see that you seeing some sort of hand that you had in that. And I was kind of assuring the caller that all of that happened long before you got involved. But did you want to talk about your experiences? Because you do in the book about how Gene Roddenberry, one of the things that worked against him was how fast these script revisions were coming in and how, what a production it was at $45 million.
Well, first of all, I certainly had nothing to do with Gene Roddenberry's being dismissed from any place. I didn't, you know, I certainly didn't know him. And by the time I came on to The Wrath of Khan, as I've indicated, Harve Bennett was the man who was in charge. And I met Gene Roddenberry. I had dealings with Gene Roddenberry, but it was only sort of way after the fact. In 1979, when they made Star Trek the Motion Picture, it was what we call a runaway production, which is to say that for whatever reason or reasons, money was just being poured at this thing. It was actually $45 million, and $45 million may not seem like an awful lot for a Hollywood movie today. But in 1979, it was simply unheard of. And the script was in such, I guess, dubious shape that the changes, the page changes that you get with scripts were not dated by the day. They were dated by the hour, as in, did you get the 4:30 changes yet, and so forth.
Right.
So it was obviously very, very confused. When I came on to Star Trek II and, you know, found myself meeting and dealing with Gene Roddenberry, he had a sort of ex officio relation to the movie. He gave a lot of notes, which, interestingly enough, I'd completely forgotten until I was back looking at a collection of my papers at the University of Iowa, and I saw all these memos flying back and forth between us that I'd completely blocked. We were always somewhat at loggerheads, Mr. Roddenberry and myself. I think he had his own sort of utopian vision of the future and of the perfectibility of man, and I always was sort of curious as to where the evidence for that was based on the story so far. So I think, you know, Star Trek is like a bottle that was created by Gene Roddenberry, and ever since, different writers, different directors, different actors, different composers sort of pour their own vintage into the general shape of that bottle. So, you know, you're given Kirk, you're given Spock, you're given McCoy, you're given these characters, you're given something of the world that they inhabit, and then it's inevitable that who's ever making the movie or the television series confers their own stamp, their own point of view, their own aesthetic sensibility onto that incarnation of Trek. And the ones I worked on, 2, 4, and 6, well, yes, I decided this is the Navy. You can call it anything you want, but this is the Navy. And, I mean, Roddenberry said, no, it's not the Navy. It's not a militaristic organization. It's the Coast Guard. And I said, I think we're splitting hairs here.
No, I don't think you are. I mean, I think that is the essential difference between those two visions, is the Coast Guard, while very cool, and I love the Coast Guard Academy, and I love the Coast Guard. I think it's a neat organization. It's not as sexy as the Navy. You know,
well, I don't know. But, I mean, there may be something to that, but it's also true that when I watched all these Star Trek episodes, I thought, well, am I not witnessing a kind of gunboat diplomacy, where at the end of the day, although they are ostensibly on sort of a peaceful mission, they do get into all sorts of scrapes and difficulties.
Yeah.
And there is a sort of an assumption that, you know, the Federation's way is the best way. It's the civilized way. And by the way, it's always a sort of a white man who's driving the boat. There may be a sort of an interracial supporting cast, but we know who's in charge.
But to go with that difference between the first Star Trek and the second Star Trek, I think it's the difference between the gatekeepers and the gate crashers.
Maybe.
And the gate crashers are a lot more interesting to watch. I mean, God bless the gatekeepers, but in terms of it being, you know, some sort of dramatic motif, it's a lot more fun to see people thrashing about and you know, taking on these bigger causes than it is people trying to keep the peace, which we need, but it doesn't necessarily make for great drama.
Well, I think, I mean, that's another thing that, you know, Roddenberry said on more than one occasion. He enunciated this idea that it would be a world without conflict. And, you know, if there ever were such a world, I think we'd all probably be extremely pleased. We might be a little bored, but we would probably overall be pleased. It's just that from a dramatist's point of view, drama is conflict and vice versa. And without
right.
it, Hamlet would be an extremely dull play.
And that's, of course, what makes Wrath of Khan so much fun, is that you've got somebody like Khan who is – Shakespearean, who's operatic, who's biblical in terms of the scope of his villainy and his revenge.
Yes, in a funny way. I mean, I think the interesting thing about Conan, and remember, this is just one more opinion. It has no more authority than anybody else's. But I find Conan to be a sort of weirdly sympathetic villain.
Sure, sure.
He was marooned, he was abandoned, and maybe Kirk's intentions were not that the planet should sort of blow up and turn into a desert, but it did, and his wife died, and he has a lot to be pissed off about.
No, he's Mr. Freeze from Batman. The character that predates Khan by, lost his wife, and all of his villainy is motivated by trying to bring his wife's suspended body back, and so that he could have her once more. And in a way, he's the most sympathetic of Batman villains for that reason. You kind of respect the fact that the guy loves his wife so much. You kind of depart with him on his method, but you know, you can feel like, well, that would be me. That would be me. I'd be that. If I had those pecs, if I had that brain, that might have been me.
Those were his pecs.
I love that. I think that surprised me. Of all the things that I've heard over the years, that really is Ricardo Montalban's body, undoctored in Wrath of Khan.
That is his body. He was a guy who was in great physical shape. And I was always, you know, you make the movie, you're busy making the movie. You don't give a lot of thought to a lot of ancillary things. And it was always greatly sort of bemusing to me that in the years that followed, the question so often asked was something that I never even, you know, thought twice other than to admire his physique.
Was, right.
Oh, man, is that real? And, oh, yeah, that was him.
Well, you had an interesting relationship with him, and I really enjoyed that. I like the fact that he responded to you as a director. He trusted you perhaps more than the other cast members did, would you say?
Well, the other cast members, the original Star Trek crew, the crew of the Enterprise, they had, after all, been playing these roles for a very, very long time. They were always extremely gracious. They were used to the idea of different directors coming along. Sometimes, I suppose, the director, as in my case, was also largely or substantively the writer. They were courteous, they were gracious, and they were professional. But different actors required different kinds of treatment. And then the director, who was in a way a kind of an audience, has got to sort of watch what's happening and think, how can I sort of get the best from these people? And the methods you use with different actors are different, whether it's encouragement or withholding or experimentation. Are we, you know, is this actor going to be at his best on take one, or is he going to be better and better with every take? It always varies. And what happened with Ricardo Montalban was the only actor I didn't get to work with prior to the movie being shot. In other words, we did rehearse with the rest of the cast, and Montalban was shooting his television series, and he wasn't available. So he came on the first day, and we shot the big scene in the cargo bays where we learned that Khan has been abandoned, and he's very, very angry about it. And so I said, let's walk through the scene, let's see what happens. And Montalban sort of bellowed this whole thing at the top of his lungs, and the soundstage was shaking with it. And I thought, whoa, this is a little big.
Well, let's pick that up there in just a second. So the first take, he gets all his marks right. He gets exactly, he says the scene right, except in the delivery, and we'll pick up that story, Nicholas Meyer and Ricardo Montalban going back to his trailer to work out what is one of the best scenes ever in a Star Trek movie. We'll talk more with Nicholas Meyer about that, and also Star Trek movies 4 and 6, and then your questions coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking with Nicholas Meyer about his view from the bridge, memories of Star Trek and a life in Hollywood. We'll talk more about Star Trek episodes 4 and 6, as well as a couple of other little side projects. He's kind enough to give us 3 hours tonight, which means you get an hour with your questions coming up on Coast to Coast. After that, in our fourth hour, your flying car awaits. Kind of a nice companion piece for this discussion about Star Trek. It's a book about how robot butlers, lunar vacations, and other dead wrong predictions of the 20th century have left many of us feeling unrequited. We thought we'd be in a different place than we are today. And we'll talk about the difference between what the predictions were for where we would be and where we are actually in the final hour on Coast to Coast. In the meantime, we'll get back to that story. We'll pick it up right where we left off, where Ricardo Montalban delivering his soliloquy, I believe it's like a 6-page soliloquy, or monologue anyway, about being stranded and about revenge and all of this going on. And he delivered it kind of at the top of his lungs, over the top Ricardo Montalban fashion. And that's where Nicholas Meyer had to step. He was kind of a crucial moment in both the movie and in his direction of the movie, and how he handled that with Ricardo Montalban to get the scene that we have today coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. By the way, knowing how much you you hate commercials, Nicholas Meyer, thank you for sitting through all of them. The View from the Bridge is the book from Nicholas Meyer. You can link up to it through coasttocoastam.com. It did not surprise me that you had a good relationship with Ricardo Montalban, because you got such a great performance out of him for Wrath of Khan. But knowing that you're an opera guy too, it might have been tempting to let Ricardo Montalban take it over the top with Khan when he really had to kind of play the scene a little more pianissimo. And so talk about that after he did his first version of this, which was sort of loud and
fortissimo.
Fortissimo, exactly. You had to pull him aside, and he was willing to go there with you. Talk about what happened after that.
Well, I bear in mind that I did not know this man. As I said, I had not had the opportunity of spending time in rehearsals with him because of his television series. So I thought, my God, this guy's got more movies to his credit than I've got years to my age. What is he going to say if this kid starts, you know, directing? But I thought I had to do something because, as I said to him, you know, Laurence Olivier once said that an actor should never show an audience his top, because once you show an audience your top, they know you got no place else to go. And Montalban was nothing if not intelligent. He was very intelligent. And he instantly sort of got what I was saying, and in the same breath he got something else. He said, oh, you're going to direct me, that's really good, I need direction, I have no idea what I'm doing up there. And then he started telling me stories about other, you know, his long sort of history of making movies with directors who said things like, you know, Ricardo, make it a good scene, or
right,
Ricardo, give it balls. And he didn't,
right,
you know, that by itself is not a terribly helpful thing. And the other thing I said,
right,
to him apropos of Khan, and I said, you know, the thing about crazy people is that crazy people don't have to shout. It's just that you never know what the hell they're going to do next.
Yeah, I loved that.
And he just took those ideas and ran with them. And once we had sort of evolved this sort of modus operandi, he would sort of look at me before he did anything and say, you know, Nick, you know, what if I raise my eyebrow here? And it got very, very, you know, sort of tiny, which ultimately I tried not to do because I wanted to leave him his own version of spontaneity. I just wanted to put sort of ideas in his head in a general,
sure,
way. And he was a guy who could complete your sentences and complete them correctly once he sort of heard the business end of it. And it was very good. And, you know, my other experience like that was when I made this television movie, my anti-nuclear epic, the day after, and
right,
working with Jason Robards was very similar in terms of that intimate collaboration that can take place where you and the actor are creating something together. And nowadays, with all the special effects, directors are much less inclined or equipped to really work with actors. It's not their expertise. It's not where the emphasis is. When I teach classes and talk to people who want to be directors, I say, the first thing I say is, take an acting class and don't sit in the back and think you're just going to watch. You got to get up there, do the scenes, make a fool of yourself, and learn what actors go through, what their process is, because you'll be able to communicate with them much better if you know what they have to go through, which is rather difficult work. I mean, most of us usually try to avoid the emotional pain spots that actors have to dredge up in order to serve up the things that you experience. And directors who have no experience or haven't put in their time learning about the actor's process, then the actor winds up just directing himself or herself, and you take your chances. And that's not how I wanted to be a director.
Well, and that shows in the final product, Wrath of Khan. Here's what I want to know, is not as the director Nicholas Meyer, but as the writer Nicholas Meyer, on the page, did you write the line for Captain Kirk that says, K-A-A-A-A-A-A-A-H-N, Khan? Or was that just a Shatner thing when he yells that line out like that?
I believe it was Bill.
Was it?
I mean, I haven't looked at the script in 30 years, so I don't know. But I mean, it was probably Khan exclamation point. Who knew?
It's such a great line. It's such an iconic line from that movie. By the way, what was the name? Do you remember the name of the ship that Khan was stranded in?
In Botany Bay,
which is in the book Voyage to Botany Bay from the 18th century. That's the first known reference to the Flying Dutchman, was in the book Botany Bay, which I was like, oh.
Oh, I had no idea. That's fascinating. Botany Bay, of course, was an Australian penal colony, yes?
Right, yeah. And I just thought, oh, that's so interesting to me, that I didn't know whether there was a connection again there or not. But that's why the view from the bridge is so interesting, too, to see the real story behind this. And I wish we could get into more about 4 and 6. We'll do what we can. I did want to leave a little bit of time to talk about The Day After before we get to people's calls. But what did Roddenberry think after he saw Wrath of Khan, knowing that you all didn't get off necessarily on the right foot? What did he end up saying about the movie?
Well, again, my acquaintance with him was really of the slightest. And somehow Gene Roddenberry had to reconcile himself to a clutch of rave reviews and the biggest opening weekend in the history of movies.
Right.
So, you know, and at the end of the day, his name is still on the thing. You know, audiences may or may not be stupid, but they're never wrong. And so there you have, you know, millions of people over a long period of time, as it now is. He must have at some point been reconciled to the idea that this was, you know, a good movie and hadn't really trounced his, you know, image of the Star Trek world, perhaps as much as he worried it would. On 6, he was a lot more worried.
Well, and so let's go there, but I'll say, reflecting back onto the movie time after time, in a way, he's H.G. Wells in his utopian vision of what Star Trek was supposed to be, and you're Jack the Ripper.
Oh, thanks.
Well, you are, in a way, because you're saying this is what it is, and it's a much more interesting film, and it's a much more interesting world in a way than the utopian vision of H.G. Wells, or for that matter, Gene Roddenberry, and you know, people, as you describe them, running around in Star Trek the movie in their Dr. Dentons, in their feety pajamas.
Well, I guess I'm sort of very flat-footed in my approach to all this stuff. I think if there is evidence of human progress, I'm not talking about technological progress, of which we have an abundance of technological process. You know, we've got one-hour photo. We've got speed dial. We've got God knows what. But are we any different? We're not any different. And the proof of this is that you can go to a production of Hamlet and weep. And it's not because you don't understand. It's because everything is exactly the same. Or you can go back even further and look at a production of Oedipus, which is Sophocles, which is 300 BC, I think. And yeah, you'll weep again. Why? Not because you don't understand what the hell is going on, but because you understand it perfectly, because we're the same.
Well, the same thing's true with the Bible.
Yes, I mean, you go. As Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun.
And I find your relationship with the divine very interesting in that you're sort of open about struggling with the idea of God or belief or whatever, but you really turn out some, I think that allows you a very interesting lens. I thought your take on comparing the Star Trek, the basics of a Star Trek movie or of the series to a Catholic liturgy, I thought was perfect. And you take that in a very interesting direction too in Star Trek VI. We'll skip over 4 just because we could talk about it more, but since you directed 6 and it has some fairly unique challenges in there, again, some of this has to do with personality challenges. By this point, you aren't the new kid on the block and you are already sort of a recognized member of the ongoing Star Trek family when you come back to it in Star Trek VI.
It's true. I was part of the group.
As the family member that sort of maybe even a prodigal son, like returning to direct Star Trek VI, I was interested in your relationship with Leonard Nimoy, which seemed testier than I would have thought.
Well, for some reason, I always managed to say the wrong thing around Leonard or do the wrong thing. There was a clumsiness on my part for which I cannot entirely account. Leonard is a highly intelligent, extremely talented, and very professional guy. And for a long time, we worked very well and harnessed together. And then, for whatever reason or series of reasons, we sort of rubbed each other funny. And I read his memoirs. We know everybody in connected with Star Trek writes a memoir. And he said he was very upset shooting Star Trek II the day they shot The Death of Spock when I showed up dressed as Sherlock Holmes to shoot this scene.
I thought that was weird.
Well, it's not only weird.
It wasn't. You weren't doing that.
I've never dressed up as Sherlock Holmes in my life. I was wearing a suit.
Right.
Yes, I was wearing a suit because...
Three-piece suit, maybe.
Yes, it was a suit with a vest. And for whatever... I had my reasons. I was going someplace when we...
You're going to the opera.
I was going to the opera. You know, Star Treks are made on sound stages or largely. I've heard people say, oh, you did Star Trek. Were you on location? And I thought, oh, yeah, we were 3 weeks on Venus. but basically, when you shoot on a sound stage, your hours are somewhat under control unless you've fallen way behind. So I was reasonably sanguine that by the time we were wrapped from shooting, I'd have time to get downtown and go to the opera. So, yes, I got dressed to go, but I wasn't in costume or anything. That's what I mean when I say we somehow sometimes would get out of sync with each other. I have nothing but the greatest respect for him. But for some reason, he made me feel or act clumsy.
And yet, out of that clumsiness came a very good Star Trek movie.
Well, Marty, I was recently. I'm the executive producer of the 60th anniversary restoration and DVD premiere of The African Queen coming soon, and we did a documentary about the making of the movie and Marty Scorsese is in the documentary, and he said, listen, movies where everything goes well and people are always nice to each other, you know, often don't add up. to the kind of movie that you get when there is tension and friction and a clash of temperaments and personality and sparks fly. And there may be something to that.
You were able, though, to come up with, again, with sort of a limited budget, which you had to fight for, which seems still odd that these movies kept proving themselves to be very profitable, and yet you were having to slug it out for an extra million here or there for special effects. You were having to crimp and save and spend a lot of your mental energy on budgets.
It was really distressing. I think, you know, Star Trek V had not been as successful as the others, and therefore they suddenly worried that the series had in fact played out and therefore were being very, very tight-fisted. And I said, oh, I'm willing to try to make a movie for the same price as Star Trek V, which I think had been 2 years previous, but I can't do it for less 2 years later because the price of everything else has gone up. And so, yeah, it was pretty unpleasant.
Well, you would have thought that not only was it a proven franchise, even Star Trek V made money, but that it was, you were a proven piece of that franchise. But then again, in a way, you have kind of a theory on that, the idea of the constriction of art, that if you that artists often tend to work better under constriction. Was that your theory, or was that you were just quoting somebody?
Well, I don't think I'm the first person to enunciate it. I don't know who was the first person to think about this. But yes, I do believe that art thrives on restriction. At its most extreme, you could make the somewhat horrific argument that art thrives on censorship, that if somebody didn't say, oh, you can't say that, or you can't show that, or you can't tell that, then you wouldn't have metaphor, you wouldn't have allegory, you wouldn't have symbolism, you wouldn't have simile, all these things where art gets, you know, sort of poetic or imagistic in order to convey something which is ostensibly forbidden. By the same token, I think that if you get to throw gazillions of dollars at something, you may get a wonderful result like Avatar, or you may simply be short-circuiting your own creative ingenuity and process. The opposite end of Avatar, I suppose, is the Olivier 1944 movie of Henry V, where, I mean, this is a medieval epic, but it was made for about three nickels and remains one of the greatest movies ever made. And they were clever. They were smart. They were ingenious. They used their imaginations and they brought off something stupendous. And that's a big inspiration for me because personally, I don't want the budget of my movie to be the same as the budget of a small country. There's something slightly troubling to me about that. It is, after all, only a movie.
Well, I've always felt the same way about, I'm a person of faith, and I always make the claim that if you had proof, you didn't need faith.
That's true.
So people often, to me, it's a fool's errand to be out there trying to prove stuff. Either you have faith or you don't. Why are people always trying to come up with the sort of smoking gun of the proof of their beliefs when that no longer requires faith?
Very original idea.
So the view from the bridge, I talk about restrictions. My restrictions prevented me from being able to get to The Day After. Maybe we can work some of that into the next hour.
I'd love to talk about The Day After.
Oh, it's so fascinating. And for that matter, too, the other work that you've done for which people will know you, including the movie The Deceivers, which I was successfully able to get from Amazon, and I watched that over the weekend.
I hope you enjoyed it.
I did enjoy it, but it seemed, if someone had just shown me that movie and said who directed it, you would be the last person I would put on that list. It's a very different movie for Nicholas Meyer. We'll talk a little bit about The Deceivers next hour, too. And Nicholas Meyer continues from the book in which he recounts his memories of Star Trek and a life in Hollywood on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.